My name's Steve and I'm an addict.
Hi, Steve.
And I would just like to say thanks, Gary. And, you know, it's quite daunting and, you know, I feel really nervous. And I'm telling myself, what have I got to say? I'm finding it difficult, really. I'm sitting here, I'm sweating. I was hoping half of you didn't come back in after you went out for a cigarette. But, hey, you're here. I suppose, you know, to start from the beginning, really. My life of drugs and started glue sniffing when I was about 12 years old, and you know, growing up in a family that I now know was dysfunctional, it was normal to me. I grew up in a normal family. You know, my dad coming home drunk and beating up my mum was normal. I thought that happened to the boy next door, and I thought it happened to everybody. And you know, so as I grew up, I was introduced to alcohol, I was introduced to that, you know, that life, that violence from my dad. And the first thing I took really was alcohol. And then when I was about 12, 13, started glue sniffing. And then it progressed on to cannabis. And, you know, all this time, you know, my dad was constantly in and out of prison. He was an absconder from the army, so, you know, the army was always after him. He was always in and out of army prisons, and then when he finally finished that, he came out and he was in and out of prison. So, you know, my life growing up was visiting my dad in prison, you know, watching him when he was out, being drunk and violent, and it wasn't a nice place to be, you know. It was, you know, I didn't know. It was like living with, you know, three people. It was like living with somebody that I never really knew. It was somebody who, you know, was drunk. And then there was this really nice man that if I said, "Dad, can I have an ice cream?" he'd flick me 50p and, you know, for me to get an ice cream. And that was about it. There was no "I love yous." There was no "good night, son." Or, you know, there was none of that. And I think growing up, I was trying to get not really acceptance from him, but I was always looking for something, and never felt I got it. And my dad died when I was 18, and you know, the drugs and the alcohol had sort of, you know, escalated, and I used to go around this guy's house. He used to fix motorbikes, and you know, if I had a problem with my motorbike or it was a scooter, and I'd take it round his house, we'd go into his front room. His mum would be in the back room, and he'd be revving up this scooter in the front room. You know, the whole house would be full up with smoke, and it turned out this guy was, you know, he was an addict. He was getting a Dicanol script and a black and white bomber script. And I used to go around there, and, you know, we was fascinated by this guy. You know, he'd sit in this big armchair and everything would be right beside him. You know, he'd have all his little paraphernalia for different drugs. And then in the corner of the room was the pile of rum bottles that he used to, once he'd finished, he'd just sling them in the room, and, you know. And, you know, I used to see these people around there taking drugs, but it was like, you know, syringes full of pink liquid, which was, you know, Dicanol. And I remember seeing this guy. He used to get a Palfium script, and he had no veins. He was gouged out in front of a fire. We went off up the shop, came back, and his whole shoulder was melted. And I just thought, you know, how can these people do this? You know, it sort of, you know, I just thought, That's not the sort of drugs I want to get involved in. And my dad died when I was 18, and the first Monday after he died, I was round this guy's house scoring Dicanol. And, you know, I'd always, when I got out of the bath, you know, I'd sit there, I'd be prodding veins in my feet, thinking, oh, I wonder what it'd be like, I wonder what it'd be like. And, you know, once my dad died, the first Monday, I was round there, and I had my first injection of Dicanol. And that was like, you know, another progression of, you know, when I look back at my life, I think about the times when I crossed the line. And, you know, that was one of the times that I crossed the line. You know, another time I crossed the line was when I was almost seemed like this normal young boy, and the next day I've got shaved head, you know, jeans up to my knees and boots, and, you know, and that was another change, you know, in my life. And, you know, from the moment I took that first injection of drug, it was... That was it. That was the only way it could be done. And, you know, progression of the drugs went on, and, you know, and I got into heroin and crack, and that lasted until I was 26. And, you know, in that time, I was in a relationship. I had a daughter. When I was 26, my daughter was 4. And, you know, the days I remember... And these are the days that, you know, that got me clean was, you know, when the front door would come in at 6 o'clock in the morning, the police would come in, my daughter would be lying in her bed shaking because she didn't know what was going on. And I'd be arguing with the police because of what they'd done. Look what you've done. You know, not taking responsibility that if I hadn't have been doing what I was doing, selling drugs, then... the police wouldn't be coming through my door. You know, I had no sense of... I thought I was allowed to do it because I was an addict, you know. I thought I had the right to sell drugs, and I thought I had the right to go and do the things that I did because I was an addict. And even when I got clean, I went to court and for non-payment of fine, and they said, what effort have you made to pay these, you know, pay these fines? And I said, well, none, you know, I'm an addict. You know, I mean, you know, how can I? And the judge said 30 days in prison. And I was like, well, hold on. You know, because people had told me if I go there and say I'm an addict, then they would say, okay, we'll squash them. But it didn't happen, you know. And one of the things, you know, that I learned in early recovery was that maybe I wasn't responsible for the things I did when I was taking drugs, but I am accountable for them. And that was one thing that I was accountable for. And it probably took me 4 years in recovery at £5 a week to pay back the fines that I owed. And, you know, when I think about the last time I got arrested for drugs, you know, there was this whole big situation. And today... I've seen this policeman that arrested me. I've seen him. I've been walking in the park and I've seen him, and I thought, wow, that's that guy that sort of, you know, stitched me up. And I wanted to go and say thank you to him. And the reason why I wanted to say thank you is because this guy saved my life, you know. If it wasn't for this guy doing what he did, then I would either be long-term in prison, probably dead, or... you know, what else? So I got clean when I was 26. I'm now 46. And the 28th of November this year, I'll be 20 years clean. Yeah. And, you know, just saying that, I mean, you know, I feel like they, look, they have. My back's all tingly. Do you know what I mean? Because has anyone got any plasters? A bit of Sellotape. Because, you know, it's amazing. It's a miracle. And I used to cringe when people say that, you know, it's a miracle. But it's a miracle, you know, that I'm nearly 20 years clean. And you know, it's gratitude to Narcotics Anonymous. you know, because when I was trying to get clean, I had a probation officer that used to say, right, there's a meeting on Friday night, Richmond, go there. And I used to think, why would I want to go there? You know, I'm using, I'm stoned. Why would I want to go and wind all these people up, sitting there gouging out? You know, because I didn't have a clue about what the whole situation was. First time I went into treatment, I thought I was going into a remand centre. You know, I had a quarter ounce of puff, you know. And as soon as I got processed, I was straight in the toilet, rolled a joint and then hanging out the window. You know, and because I only thought I had a problem with heroin because it gave me this physical withdrawal when I got up in the morning. Everything else was a mental obsession and I thought it was okay. And it took me quite a long time. Well, it wasn't really. It was about a year or so to realise that it was total abstinence and the only way I was going to stay clean was not to use anything. And the last time I used was I met a guy in a treatment centre and, you know, we became friends. We used to go to meetings. He was staying at Thurston House and I used to crash on the floor. You know, we'd go out because I could have sworn when I first came around it said 90 clubs in 90 days. So, you know, we would go to the NA dance, you know, and they'd be, yeah, come on in this. You know, because I'd never danced before. You know, it was too busy, you know, as it says in the readings, you know, getting and using and finding ways and means to get more. That's what my life was about. And so we'd go to these NA dances, we'd be up on the stage dancing, and then after that it would be a club. And you know, then I got a job with this guy, his brother. We was, you know, selling Moody perfume outside Harrods, and we was like the lookouts, and you know, for when the police come. And after work, we'd go in a little pub next to Harrods, and his brother would pay us. And I wanted to buy his brother a drink, and I bought him a drink, and I bought him a pint of lager. And as I gave it to him, I put it down, and it dripped on my fingers. And my first reaction was to lick my fingers. So the next night, we're in exactly the same situation, and he says to me, do you want a drink? I said, well, I want half a lager, but I'll have a Coke. And he said, yeah, but you're okay to have half a lager, surely. And I went, oh, all right then. So I had a half a lager. The other guy that was with me that was in treatment said, oh, go on in, I'll have a brandy. So then, you know, a few lagers later, he says, I feel like I'm going to get some Coke. And I said, no, that's it. No, I'll stop you. So we've gone to a different pub and he's come up to me, he said, give 15 quid, I'm going to get a rock. And I just went like that, just give him the money. And he's gone off with a girl in a cab, come back with the drugs. Me and him have gone into the men's toilets, climbed out the window, gone to his flat, which was just up above the pub, and we're standing there in shorts, smoking crack, looking out the window, laughing at the girl standing outside the pub, you know, looking for us. And that was, you know, that was someone saying it was okay for me to have half a lager, you know. And, you know, that was the last time I used. And, you know, recovery for me is just... You know, I always used to be at the... I remember I had a counsellor and she always used to say to me, every time I see you, you've got a different T-shirt on with a different convention on it. You know, because I always used to go to the conventions and... you know, and I met my wife. My wife's over there. We've been together 18 years. And I met her at a convention in Bristol. And who says, you know, relationships in recovery don't work? You know, we've been just celebrated 10 years of marriage and been together 18 years. And, you know, for me, it's about, you know, there's a saying that says it works if you work it. And some people don't quite get that it works if you work it. You know, it doesn't work if you run away. You know, it works if you work it. And... you know, sometimes it's very, very, very difficult. you know, sometimes I want to say I cannot do this anymore, you know, and whether that's being in a relationship, whether that's, you know, running my own business or, you know, whatever, it's sometimes I just say I can't do this anymore, you know, and, you know, I just persevere, I just walk through it, and at the end of it, it's like, wow, what was all that about? And I'm actually, you know, when I sat down in this chair, I thought, oh, my God, you know, I've got to sit there and talk for 40 minutes. Mm-hmm. You know, and I was really nervous. And now I'm sitting and I'm thinking, what was all that about? You know, what was all that? You know, it wasn't like, it wasn't a fear. It was just... maybe an anxiety, you know, because I've got to be a little bit vulnerable, I've got to talk about myself, you know, I've got to speak and hope everybody, you know, gets something out of what I've said, and, you know, that makes me anxious, you know, that, you know, because it's not doing, you know, my wife said to me on the way here, are you scared? And I was like, well, I'm not scared, it's not, you know, it's like having a tattoo done. It's painful, it hurts, but it's not a pain where you're going to cry your eyes out. You know, it hurts. Yeah, so my home group is Richmond, and when I first went to that meeting on a Friday night, there was five people, and I walked in there. I got the reading, what is Narcotics Anonymous, and... started reading it before I even read it out, just to make sure that I knew most of the words and I wasn't going, you know, narcotics, you know. So I just went through it and just sort of, you know, made sure I could read it and everybody can understand. And then it said, you know, about we're not interested in it or how much you used or your connections were, what you did in the past. And I was thinking, yeah. That's handy, you know, because I can't really tell them who I used to score off in case they go round there, you know, and ask them if, you know, because that was the mentality of, you know, being a junkie, was that, you know, I didn't want to let you know who I was getting it from in case you was going round there, you know, or in case you went round there. You know, it was all this, you know, secret lifestyle. And, you know, I've got to say, I'm really, really grateful that I have not got to do any of that, you know. I've got two brothers and they both use. One of them at the moment, I've got him working with me and I'm really struggling with it, you know, because he's got clean, he's been, you know, he's had some clean time. And last year, I've got a 16-year-old son and... my son gave up his room and we put an inflatable bed in our room and my son slept on this bed while my brother detoxed in his bedroom. And, you know, for me, that was a big, big, you know, I was like, you know, 19 years clean and I'm giving my brother sleeping tablets to every night because, you know, I want this guy to get clean. And... and, you know, he gets clean, he goes back to his house, and within a week he's using again. And you know, it really, really, really hurts to the fact that, you know, because what I think about is, you know, my son gave up his room, you know, for you, you know, and, you know, and I've got a sort of... I'm in the process at the moment of making a decision about letting him go, and it's, you know, it's really difficult when, you know, you see somebody that's in, you know, pain. He's got nothing in his life, you know. Well, he's got things in his life, but he's got nothing what I would say good in his life, and. You know, so I employ him because he's good at what he does, but it's interfering with my, you know, my integrity and my, you know, my beliefs about, you know, recovery, about being an addict, about using. You know, of course I can have empathy for people who use drugs because, you know, I know what it's like. But bottom line is I'm enabling him, you know, because I'm employing him and giving him money every week so he doesn't have to go out and get consequences. Now, I wouldn't have got clean if I didn't have consequences. It was my consequences that got me clean. And, you know, it's really difficult to make a decision to say, right, go and get your consequences and then come back and get recovery, you know. Because his consequence might be that he might not survive, you know. And that's, you know, difficult because as I was clean and, you know, and as, you know, my recovery was going on, I was always waiting for that knock on the door, you know, because I'd see people in meetings, you know, and they'd say, oh, have you seen so-and-so? And I'd say, no, yeah, he's dead, you know, he died, she died, and, you know, it's not a nice thought to have about, you know, your own family member. And, you know, and part of me thinks, well, you know, if that's his path, that's his path. But I don't know, it's really, really difficult. You know, and it does come down to, you know, step one, you know, being powerless. And about being powerless, when I went into a treatment centre, you know, there was the big steps on the wall, the big traditions on the wall and stuff, and I was reading through them and I was thinking, powerless, you know, step one, powerless. Don't know. I didn't think I was powerless. You know, I thought, I'm, you know, quite a strong guy. How can I be powerless? You know, because that powerless to me was strength. And unmanageability was like, how can I be unmanageable? Because I managed to get drugs every day. You know, because that was my vocabulary with them words, and it wasn't until it was pointed out to me that the things that I did to me and to other people for the drugs was why I was powerless. And, you know, depriving my daughter or whatever of food for me, for drugs, was me being that my life was unmanageable. And, you know, I couldn't see all that. You know, and then I'd watch a TV program and they'd mention certain words and I'd think, wow, that's like recovery, you know, because my words were, how much have you got? Can I pop round? Or how long will you be? And, you know, I remember I phoned this guy up and he said he'd be there in 10 minutes and 5 hours later he still hadn't turned up and I phoned him up again. I said, what's happening? Where are you? And he's, yeah, I'll be there in a minute. And I'm sitting there thinking, when he turns up, I'm going to tell him, fuck off. You know, because he's taking a piss. He's been 5-6 hours, and he knocks at the door, and I open the door, go, oh, no, mate, come in. You know, and then he cracks some silly joke, and I go, yeah, you know. Part of me just think, just get your gear out, mate. You know, and that was one of the things that I really hated about being on drugs, was that, I would sell myself short most of the time. And, you know, if I drank alcohol and, you know, it would be like, what are you looking at? Because that's what, that's what I saw when I grew up. And then when I got into heroin, somebody could come and poo on my lap and I would brush it off and go, thanks, mate. Because I didn't want any conflict. All I wanted was my drugs. That was it. And, you know, today I have some self-respect. I have some, you know, self-esteem. And there's no way that I would want myself in that situation, you know, of using drugs. You know, my son at the moment is, you know, he's just finished school and, you know, he's just done his GCSEs. And it's been quite, you know, a time for me, because I was, you know, I'm worried. You know, I'm worried that he's going to do okay. You know, he's very bright, but he's lazy. And, you know, and I'm wondering whether he's going to be okay. And I have all these projections about, you know, that he's going to be working with me for the rest of his life. And, you know, and I don't really want that. I want him to do better. You know, I want him to, you know, to go out there and do what he wants to do. And so I don't really know what else to say. I mean, I know it's cutting it a bit short, but I just want to say that I'm really, really grateful for being here and, you know, having the honour, really, to share in front of everybody. And, you know, and Narcotics Anonymous saved my life. And, yeah, it's good to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.